Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 16, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on two immigration cases in the Supreme Court, where this week the U.S. Supreme Court issued two immigration rulings on two cases. And my name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome to talk about the two cases someone who should be well-known to all of you on the call, Professor John C. Eastman, who is the director at the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law. He also is the chairman of the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Professor Eastman, and then after his presentation, we'll go to, as always, questions from the audience. So Professor Eastman, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Christian, and I'm delighted to be back on the podcast again today. Just one addition to my bio: the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, as many of you probably know, is affiliated with the Claremont Institute, and I just kind of want to give due deference to my other hat where possible. So the Supreme Court yesterday decided two cases, both of them immigration cases, both raising fairly technical issues in immigration law. We're going to put them in context because at least one of them, Kerry versus Dinn, is widely being touted as kind of some preliminary tea leaf reading into the marriage cases. And so let me start with that one. It's often the case when you've got major landmark cases sitting on the docket that the justices are jostling with each other in cases leading up to that. They'll be putting language in footnotes or writing opinions with those cases coming down the pike in mind. We saw Justice Kennedy's opinion in the Schuette versus Michigan affirmative action case last year, for example, talking extensively about the role of the people in democratic societies in deciding controversial social policy questions. You can't read that without thinking the marriage cases were at least in his mind. And so too with yesterday's case, Kerry versus Dinn. It is as much about the marriage cases, or at least the tea leaving. And I understand it makes us all somewhat like old criminologists, where we're trying to look at the latest picture of the Politburo to see who's standing next to whom, to try and make assessments of who's gaining in power and who's losing in power. And this one has an odd lineup on that criminology type front. So let me describe the case and then go into those aspects of it. Fawzia Dinn is a naturalized U.S. citizen. The opinion doesn't say where she's originally from. I suspect Afghanistan, but I'm not certain of that. Anyway, she's a naturalized U.S. citizen. She came to the United States in 2000. She became a naturalized citizen in 2007. In 2006, she married Kamisha Barask, who's currently an Afghan citizen and also was an employee of the Taliban government when they were in charge in Afghanistan. Fawzia Dinn, the wife, sought a visa for her husband, and she was given permission to have him take that step. But then when he applied for a visa, he was denied. And the consular office simply cited the statutory provision providing requiring denial of visas to anyone engaged in terrorist activities. And it's a very broad definition under the U.S. Patriot Act. Anybody that worked for a terrorist organization, that gave aid and material support to a terrorist organization, and it sounds like his former job as a payroll clerk in the welfare office of the old Taliban government in Afghanistan might well qualify. Nevertheless, he didn't bring suit, and everybody agrees that he doesn't have a ground to bring suit because there's no constitutional right to immigrate to the United States, and denials of that by the person denied are not subject to review. So the wife, Fawzia Dinn, brought the suit, and she alleged, and here's where the marriage cases come in, she alleged that their denial of the visa to him deprived her of the right to live with her spouse and have her marriage fully recognized as living together in the United States. And so whether there's a constitutionally protected right to marriage and what that means, of his course, all of a sudden jumps to the forefront of the case. Now, back on the immigration issue, there's kind of a spectrum of decisions out there that kind of govern the technicalities of the case. Two cases from the 1950s called Knauf versus Shaughnessy and Shaughnessy versus U.S. ex relator Mazzi. Both held that essentially that the decisions by the consular office to deny admission are unreviewable. Both of those cases involved claims of secret evidence that the consular office relied on. In the Knauf case, a non-citizen wife was denied admission based on secret evidence, and that was okay according to the court. And in the Mazzi case, the non-citizen resident was denied a return after he had left to visit a dying relative, again, based on non-secret evidence. And those two cases have been taken. I mean, these questions are non-reviewable even by the courts. However, on the other side of the spectrum, in 1972, the Supreme Court in Kleindienst versus Mandel denied a visa to a Marxist journal that a number of faculty members at Stanford University had sought to come give a speech and listen to. So the U.S. citizen sued, alleging that their First Amendment right to hear him had been denied. Now, the Supreme Court upheld the denial of the visa, but only after determining that his prior visa violations was sufficient reason for it, and those were cited by the consular office. So that case is often interpreted as not a denial of review by the courts, but a pretty deferential review of the consular decision. And so the United States in this case argued the more hard line, that the consular decision was entirely unreviewable. And on that ground, but not on for that reason, Justice Scalia writes the plurality opinion. He's joined by Chief Justice Roberts, more on that significant piece in a moment, and Justice Thomas. And he doesn't deal so much with this Kleindienst, is it unreviewable, is it reviewable, but highly deferential. He says there's no constitutional right at stake. He blasts Justice Breyer's description in dissent that the wife, Fawzia Din, was making a claim that she has a freedom to live together with her spouse in America, that that's the basis of the constitutional claim. Rather, Justice Scalia says, it's just the spouse's freedom to immigrate to the United States, and there's no such constitutionally protected right. Now, concurring in the judgment, not concurring in the opinion, but concurring only in the judgment, is Justice Kennedy, joined by Justice Alito. And again, that Alito piece is significant for the broader aspects of this case. But here, just on the whole, and Justice Kennedy says, he would not have reached the issue of whether there's a protectable liberty interest to live together with your spouse, as you define it, so you can see the marriage cases lurking over that. But even if she had such a protectable interest, she got all the notice and due process that was required. The consular office had cited the statutory provision. Now, granted, it's a broad provision. It has several grounds for requiring the denial of a visa. They didn't point out which specific ground it was, but nevertheless, he said that was sufficient. That's the point on which Justice Breyer disagrees most significantly in dissent, but he also thinks there's a protected liberty interest here. And so on that point, Justice Breyer, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, all considered to be four solid votes in the marriage cases for finding a constitutional right to marriage, found that Mrs. Fawzia Din has a protected liberty interest in living with her spouse in America. And then the second piece of Justice Breyer's dissent is that the procedures followed here, particularly the lack of any detail on why they were denying the visa, were inadequate and therefore violated due process. So that's the setup and what the court holds. Normally we wouldn't give much highlight to you know, kind of the technicalities on such an immigration case, but for this overlay. And here's why I want to shift briefly on the lineup. Obviously, Justice Kennedy saying we're going to leave open the question on whether there's a protectable liberty interest in living together with your spouse is interesting, and most people in the marriage cases think Justice Kennedy is the deciding swing vote. There's a great deal of speculation from the left of the political commentary, and even some from the from the right that Chief Justice Roberts is entertaining going with Justice Kennedy and the more liberal members of the court on the right, fundamental right to marry, includes the right to marry someone of the same sex issue as well. But here, this lineup, Chief Justice Roberts does not join Justice Kennedy's opinion, keeping that liberty interest question open. He instead joins Justice Scalia's opinion, which says there's no such right. Now, it's not exactly the same right as at issue in the marriage cases, but I think the fact that the chief is joining Justice Scalia's plurality opinion there is significant. Very interesting that Justice Alito sides with Kennedy, and I don't think there's anybody that thinks Justice Alito's a vote up for grabs in the marriage cases. So there's some very interesting tea leaves. You guys can make of it what you want in this case, but it gives an added level of interest in this particular case. The second case that was decided yesterday, immigration case, what one SCOTUS blogger called a hyper-technical case, question of immigration jurisdiction, was Race Mata versus Lynch. And the court seems pretty much in agreement here. It was 8-1, and even that masks a greater level of agreement between the justices than the number itself suggests. So the technical question, if you commit certain kinds of crime, the statutes say that you shall be placed into removal proceedings. That's some of the provisions that the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, and the President are saying they don't have to. It doesn't really mean shall. They can not take anybody out of removal proceedings if they want. That's the whole fight over the President's executive actions on immigration of late. But here we assume this gentleman gets put into removal proceedings. He's ordered removed. He files a notice of appeal to the Bureau Bureau of Immigration Appeals. But his lawyer never files the briefing, and the BIA eventually dismisses his appeal. 100 days later, new counsel files a motion to reopen. But the immigration statutes say you have to file a motion to reopen within 90 days, and so he's out of time. And the BIA denies the motion to reopen as untimely, and he appeals to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit says it doesn't have jurisdiction because it has previously determined that the 90-day rule is not subject to equitable tolling, which is the real issue, the merits issue in the case. And because it's not subject to equitable tolling, the only ground that he could have been seeking to reopen his removal proceedings is the entirely discretionary authority for the BIA to reopen a proceeding on its own, sua sponte. And that's a completely unreviewable decision, and so therefore the Fifth Circuit held that it had no jurisdiction to consider the appeal. And it's on that question, and only that question, that the Supreme Court disagrees. Justice Kagan writes the opinion, and she says, whether or not there's equitable tolling is the merits question. Our ability to review that question is the jurisdictional question, and because the court always has jurisdiction to consider the merits question that's determinative on whether it has jurisdiction, its denial of jurisdiction was wrong. So if you can follow that through, you'll understand the case and also understand why SCOTUS blog is describing this as a hyper-technical question of immigration jurisdiction. For those inside the Beltway, inside the park, gamers on the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General chose not to defend the judgment of the court below on the jurisdictional question, so the court appointed a former Clarence Thomas clerk and a former Edith Jones clerk who works at a firm as an associate in Houston. He performed his services admirably, according to the court in a footnote, and made an argument that at least persuaded Justice Thomas that this question of jurisdiction was a closer call than the court otherwise suggests. So that's the hyper-technical case. And with that, I think I'll end the summary of the cases and open it up for questions and discussion, because particularly Kerry versus Did, I think there might be a lot of Politburo criminologists out there to want to kind of feed into some of the details on that.
All right. Thank you for that excellent presentation, Professor Eastman. So, yeah, as Professor Eastman said, we'll go to your questions.
In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And just a quick programming note for all of you in the Washington, D.C. area. Our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference is this Thursday, June 18th, and it is free to attend. So if you're interested in stopping by, go to our website at fedsoc.org to register. And so again, if you've got questions or a comment or would like to discuss one of the aspects of the cases, press star and then the pound key.
While we're waiting for some questions to queue up, let me go into a little more on Kerry versus Dinn. So interestingly, celebrating 800th anniversary of the signing of Magna Carta, which was yesterday, this opinion, both the plurality opinion of Justice Scalia and the dissenting opinion of Justice Breyer, cite Magna Carta. So I think they wanted to let the world know that they're remain very keen on that document and what it means. But Justice Scalia, of course, had a view of it that it meant what it said, and really mockingly took issue with some of our modern fundamental rights jurisprudence that is so far removed from the kind of things that were protected by the Due Process Clause, which has its roots in Magna Carta. He says, in particular, Mrs. Dinn claims that the government denied her due process of law when, without adequate explanation for the reason of the visa denial, it deprived her of her constitutional right to live in the United States with her spouse. There is no such constitutional right. And then he goes on and addresses Justice Breyer's claim directly. He says, what Justice Breyer's dissent strangely describes as a deprivation of her freedom to live together with her spouse in America is, in any world other than the artificial world of ever-expanding constitutional rights, nothing more than a deprivation of her spouse's freedom to immigrate into America, of course, which is not a constitutionally protected right. So you can see the issue joined there, and the issue is about the ever-expanding notion of constitutional fundamental rights, or even here as a non-fundamental but important constitutional right that, because it's important, ought to get certain levels of procedural protection that we don't even give to the enumerated rights that are protected by the Due Process Clause. So Justice Scalia points out that anomaly in the dissent's theory as well, which, again, kind of lays the ground for the fights that I'm sure are still being had over the marriage cases.
Well, Professor Eastman, we have a fairly large audience on, but still no questions at this time. Perhaps they're thinking of them at the moment. Let's see.
So everybody's shying away from the hyper-technical grounds of immigration law, with reason, no doubt. Let me go further a little bit into the language of Justice Scalia's opinion. So here he takes on a whole section describing modern fundamental rights analysis. You know, after having laid out what the Magna Carta actually protects, you know, the freedom from imprisonment without, you know, trial or without charges, the imposition of fines, the loss of your property and of your liberty and of your life, of course, if it's a more significant capital crime. That's what the Magna Carta set out, and what we largely replicated, although with different language, in the Due Process Clause. So Scalia says, despite this historical evidence, this court has seen fit on several occasions to expand the meaning of liberty under the Due Process Clause to include certain implied fundamental rights. The reasoning presumably goes like this: if you have a right to do something, you are free to do it, and a deprivation of freedom is a deprivation of liberty, never mind the original meaning of that word in the Due Process Clause. These implied rights have been given more protection than the life, liberty, or property properly understood. And so it's just dripping with mocking assessment of the modern enterprise. I have no doubt, though, that we're going to see that line. These implied rights have been given more protection than the life, liberty, or property, properly understood. Taken out of context and away from its mocking tone, we'll see those in briefs, you know, for why there are expanded procedural protections for implied fundamental rights. Of course, Scalia's meaning there is exactly the opposite. Anyway, so that you know, and then he lays out what is could just as easily be a section of the opinion drawn directly from a majority opinion on the marriage cases, or a dissenting opinion, depending on how that case bounces. He says, "I think it worth explaining why, even if one accepts the textually unsupported doctrine of implied fundamental rights, Mrs. Dinh's arguments would fail." Because extending constitutional protection to an asserted right or liberty interest places the matter outside the area of public debate and legislative action, citing Washington versus Glucksberg. Because the guideposts for responsible decision-making are scarce and open-ended, citing Collins versus Harker Heights. The doctrine of judicial self-restraint requires us to exercise the utmost care whenever we are asked to break new ground in this field. And so that's exactly the arguments, and in fact, in exactly those terms that appear in many of the briefs in the marriage cases. And he goes on and explains why, even if there were a liberty interest in marriage, it doesn't apply in context when the restrictions on it are of historical and longstanding existence. And he goes on and criticizes the broad use of language. And he distinguishes cases like Loving and Zablocki and Turner, the very three cases that are kind of on the front edge of the arguments in the marriage cases, and he just kind of rebuts those positions. And the reason I think that is so significant is because it's on several of those points that some have speculated Chief Justice Roberts may be still open on the marriage cases, and he joins Justice Scalia's opinion in full on all of those points. So I think you know that's very significant, and it goes back to my longstanding prediction that the marriage cases will be 5-4 with Justice Kennedy, not anybody else, being the deciding vote. And I think this lineup on this case lends great support to that view. Okay, so there we are. There's one last piece of this. And this is on the argument in the marriage case is that we're not asking for a new fundamental right, so that triggers the Glucksberg analysis. All we are asking for is the application of an existing fundamental right to a new group of people. And Justice Scalia addresses that point as well. Even if the cases could be construed so broadly, he says, to recognize this right to have your spouse living in the United States, the marriage question, the relevant question is not whether the asserted interest is consistent with this court's substantive due process line of cases, but whether it is supported by this nation's history and practice. So he continues, even if we might imply a liberty interest in marriage, generally speaking, that must give way when there is a tradition denying the specific application of that general interest. Boy, does that kind of encapsulate the fight in the marriage cases really succinctly. It's just that one. And again, not just Justice Alito, I mean Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, but Chief Justice Roberts joins this opinion.
Well, I do, again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Eastman, press star and then the pound key. I do want to draw everyone's attention to one very interesting Teleform conference call that we have scheduled tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. As some of you may be aware, this year is the 65th anniversary of Professor Lon Fuller's classic law review article, The Case of the Spelunkian Explorers. And tomorrow, in a special feature, we're actually bringing together legal scholars from Canada, Australia, and the United States to discuss the continuing relevance and appeal of the article. And so that is tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and will be a nice trip down memory lane for many of you back to law school. And I'm sure Professor Eastman is quite familiar with the case.
Yes.
So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
And while we're waiting on that, one of the big questions people have is what do the next 2 weeks hold? And the court has announced an additional hand-down day. Well, the original schedule published had hand-down days yesterday, next Monday, the 22nd, and then the final hand-down day of Monday, the 29th, that last week of the court's term. They've announced that they'll be doing an additional hand-down day this Thursday. There are still 17 cases to come out with only three hand-down days scheduled. They typically do three or maybe four cases a day. So we're likely to get at least one more hand-down day scheduled, maybe two. And it people often speculate, is there some strategic maneuvering going on? Are they holding the most high-profile cases for the last day of the term so they can release them and then get out of town? No, what really is going on is the most significant cases are often the most contested ones. People are writing back and forth. They're adding footnotes, responding to other opinions. They're writing concurrences. They're deciding not to join Section 2 because the author of it wasn't willing to make a requested change. All of those kind of back and forths have a higher level of intensity with the high-profile cases, and particularly when you've got high-profile cases like we have this year that were argued very late in the term. The marriage cases were argued on April 28th, the second of the last day of oral argument. And the Burwell Affordable Care Act exchange cases was argued in March, also very late in the term. And I'm sure they're still going back and forth those. And as soon as the opinion is ready, it will be released. But it's not a surprise that those high-profile things, like any law professor writing an article, they continue to be worked on until the deadline is hard upon them, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Well, Professor Eastman, we did have two questions that jumped on, and so appreciate you filling a little time there for us and going into more detail. I guess we can go to the first one.
Hi, my name is Dagmar Rick, and I'm an immigration attorney. And I have a question. If the Supreme Court decides that the marriage is a fundamental right, that would have huge implications on immigration for all the spouses who entered the country illegally and right now cannot stay in the United States. There is no possibility to apply for a green card through their spouse. So would then the Constitution trump the immigration law, which makes it impossible right now for these spouses to apply?
Well, clearly not under the the plurality opinions ruling by Justice Scalia. He says it doesn't undermine the right. Nobody's saying that they can't be married. You don't have a right to live in this country with your spouse, is what the right would be claimed. And it's of longstanding notion that the admissibility of a spouse is up to the plenary discretion of Congress. And so even a Supreme Court ruling in the marriage cases, were it to reach such a ruling that there's a fundamental right to marry whomever you want, a ban on admission for an inadmissible alien spouse doesn't undermine their fact that they're married. The spouse can choose to live in a country where they're both permitted to reside. So it really is still the fundamental right to immigrate to this country that's at issue, not the right to marry. And the plurality and the concurring opinion both agree on that. So now, whether you have a liberty interest in being with your spouse in the United States is the question that Justice Kennedy in concurrence keeps open. But again, the marriage case itself is not going to decide that question, and it's. Corollarily and not directly related to the marriage question in the pending in the marriage cases. So I don't think we'll have an answer to that anyway. What's significant about Justice Scalia's opinion, though, is the claim that, for example, children who are born here and are by being born on U.S. soil are treated as U.S. citizens. We could go into whether that's a correct interpretation of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment or not. But assuming they are citizens, and that when their parents are deported, they have often made claims that they are being deprived of their right to the family relationship. Well, Justice Scalia's opinion says effectively that's not true. They, you know, the requirements of being here president of the United States lawfully have nothing to do with whether the citizen children wants to stay part of that family unit in a place where they can do so. The government doesn't prevent that. It just says that somebody who's not entitled to be lawfully present in the United States doesn't have that right. And so it kind of addresses that question in a very significant way. But again, that's the plurality opinion, three justices on it. We don't know where Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito would be on such a question, but I think it was pretty significant that the holding and the reasoning of Justice Scalia's plurality opinion would foreclose such claims, even in the context of children citizens.
All right. Well, we still have one question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you'd like to make a if you have a question for Professor Eastman on either of the cases or the implications, press star and then the pound key now. But we'll go right to our one pending question.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. The obvious areas of interest in this case are the ones that have been discussed with respect to the potential impact on the gay marriage case currently before the court. But here on the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, I'm actually more interested in a comment that the professor made about the refusal or declining of the administration basically to argue the position upholding the law and appointing a special solicitor general, I guess would be the appropriate title to do so. That seems to me to be a violation of the fundamental tenet of separation of powers brought and the rule of law brought down since the Magna Carta, as exemplified in Article 2, Section 3's requirement that the executive shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Would you care to comment on what seems to me to be an increasing trend of the government being, the executive branch, being unwilling to uphold the laws that in fact have been duly passed by Congress and, signed by presidents?
And as you probably know, I've been a very vocal critic of the administration's decisions in a number of areas. Its decision not to enforce our drug laws, its decisions not to enforce our immigration laws, its decision not to enforce the terms of the Affordable Care Act when they proved to be politically inconvenient. And I think that it has abused its discretion. It has created categorical suspensions of the law. Certainly in the immigration context, for example, that exceed prosecutorial discretion, and it has awarded benefits that for which there is no statutory authority and therefore exceeded that one of the core requirements of separation of powers, that the lawmaking power, the power to align benefits and what have you, is a legislative, not an executive power. And I've been extremely critical on all those fronts. However, I don't think that criticism applies to its decision, the narrow decision in the Rees-Mata versus Lynch case, not to defend the judgment below. There are a couple of merits issues. Does the statutory 90-day requirement to file an application to reopen your removal appeal, is that equitably subject to equitable tolling, and does ineffective assistance of counsel claims qualify as grounds for equitable tolling? Those are merits issues that were contested in the court below. The Fifth Circuit, however, held that it had no jurisdiction. That was the holding, and that was an aspect of the holding that the United States disagreed with, and so it didn't want to defend on that jurisdictional question. That's a very close call, and I don't begrudge them not wanting to defend that aspect of the Fifth Circuit's decision, which is the only holding in the case at the moment. And when we've had questions like this, because the executive in their independent obligation to act constitutionally determines that the lower court decision is not valid, the court itself will appoint an amicus to present argument in defense of the lower court decision. And we had it in the Dickerson case. We've had it in several cases. So that's not particularly extraordinary. And I think it's different than their absolute refusal. If they were saying some other aspect of this immigration law we don't like, so we're not going to, you know, we're not going to defend a judgment upholding the constitutionality of that decision, then I would put it in the context as you've described. But this one I think is much more technical than that, and I even though I have a great deal of disagreement with them on this issue generally, not on the particular application of it here.
Professor
Eastman, thank you for that distinction.
Oh, go ahead.
Was there a follow-up there?
No, I was just saying thank you for that clarification.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Now, Professor Eastman, the first example when you talked about, wasn't something like that done, I believe, in the first iteration of the Bond case that came before the court where...
Yeah, exactly. So in Bond versus United States, this was Carol Ann Bond's challenge to the constitutionality of the federal statute implementing the International Treaty Against Chemical Weapons. And the statute is written so broadly that it applied to any routine assault that used a chemical. She challenged that as exceeding Congress's enumerated powers. The Third Circuit had originally held that only a state government can raise such a Tenth Amendment enumerated powers limitation type of argument. And the government declined to defend that decision, even though on the merits they thought that this was a valid statute. And the court on that question appointed a counsel to defend the lower court judgment. It's rare but not improper for the court to do so, I think is the best way to describe it.
Well, our lines are open, so if you've got any final questions or comments for Professor Eastman, I want to pick his brain about any aspect of constitutional law, he's available for you.
We kick in my normal hourly rate, guys.
Well, we did have one more caller, so we'll. I'm interested to see what their question is.
Hello. I was wondering if in the argument or in the opinion, the justices or the advocates discussed the difference between a right and a privilege. So I guess the defendant or the person who wants her husband to live in the United States is asserting a right, whereas the fact that she's in the United States is kind of a privilege to begin with. I'm not sure she's in a position to demand anything addition to that.
It does come up in the opinion. Justice Breyer, in his dissenting opinion, accuses Justice Scalia of reviving that old distinction between rights and privileges, which the court, a couple decades ago, rejected. Justice Scalia says, "That's not what I'm doing at all. You misunderstand." And so that old distinction, which was rejected in Goldberg versus Kelly, remains rejected. That what Justice Scalia is taking issue with is whether she has a right to insist that the government give her husband a visa to the United States when he clearly has no right to obtain that visa. I think he talks about it in terms of rights rather than privileges and rejects the notion that there is such a fundamental right. And another interesting aspect of this case is he says, but Justice Breyer doesn't even claim it's a fundamental right. He seems to acknowledge that it's at most an implied non-fundamental right, but that nevertheless gets more due process protections than we give to the enumerated fundamental rights in the Due Process Clause itself. And so there's that fight going on as well. And Justice Breyer really doesn't confront Justice Scalia's criticism of that in his opinion, at least not adequately in my view.
You reference another case where that issue comes up. What was the holding in that case? I mean, is a privilege actually a right?
The issue was Goldberg versus Kelly. We have a statutory scheme of welfare benefits. I forget the exact details of the case. And tied to that statutory scheme is certain procedural rights that flow if you're deprived of your welfare benefits. Among those was the right to have a post-hearing review and appeal of the decision, but not a pre-deprivation appeal and of the decision. And because that was tied to the statutory benefit, which was not a constitutional right, but only existed by virtue of the statute, and therefore it was a right confined with the procedural requirements, the argument was made, you can't claim more than the statute sets out. The court disagreed with that, and disagreed with it in part by saying, you know, you're treating this as if it's some only a privilege. Well, the statute has defined a right, and once we define the right, the Constitution sets what the procedures are that are required. You can't limit those procedures in the statute itself. And that decision, therefore, means that the old notion that it was a privilege conferred by statute rather than a right kind of goes by the wayside.
Okay, I'm not sure I understood all that, but I guess I can do some research on my own. But
yeah, Goldberg versus Kelly is the case, and there's zillions of commentaries about it and on just that question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
And just a reminder for those of you listening in, if you missed any part of the conference call or just want to listen to it again, this conference call as well as all of our other previous conference calls are posted as podcasts on our website at fedsoc.org. So you can always go download or stream these later should you want to revisit the material. Well, let's do a last call for questions. We still have time, but for those of you still on the call, if you have any final thoughts or questions to share with us or ask Professor Eastman, press star and the pound key now. And again, one final reminder for both our Spelunky and Explorers case, Teleform tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern, as well as our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference here in Washington, D.C. this Thursday, which is, again, the information is available online, and you can register at fedsoc.org, and it is free to attend. So, well, it looks like we've exhausted all the questions. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Professor Eastman for joining us once again to provide insightful commentary and analysis and for taking your questions. And thank you all for to the audience for taking time out of your day to join us. And we hope to see you again on future Teleform conference calls.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.